Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, my radio listeners. You are getting it right with Dr. Bowles. I am so excited to have you join me this afternoon in Alexandria, Louisiana. It is starting to storm, but in September, that's nothing new because this is hurricane season. The good news is I'm in central Louisiana, and therefore I'm not down on the Gulf Coast worrying about the tornadoes and the like, but it still rains and it does give us a lot of noise here in central Louisiana. For those of you who have been following since I got back on the radio in late August, I have been talking about social justice in the United States. If you had a chance to look at the marquee, you could read what today's topics would kind of bounce around on. I am very lucky to tell you that I also have my guest, Cassandra Bell Gash. How are you doing, Cassandra?
Doing well. Thank you, Dr. Bowles.
Well, I'm excited. We talked a little bit earlier before the radio show just what social justice is. And for the listeners who had a chance to look at the marquee, you would have noticed that there are some who will say there is no such thing as social justice, nor should there be. And I think that's a bit controversial. But to back it up, before I engage you on your opinion, Cassandra, I'm just going to review what I did propose in the write-up for today, that social justice imposes on each of us a personal responsibility to work with others to design and continually perfect personal and social development. Now, that's my definition borrowed and incorporated from other persons, but in general, it says that we have a responsibility, we being people at large, that if you want the right to live in a social society, and I say that because if you watch a lot of the new television shows, they give you these actual lifestyles, and Alaska is very popular, and Naked and Alive is Naked and Afraid, I think it is another one, where it's reality shows. You're seeing people trying to escape in some way or the other society. They don't want to be doing the everyday thing, following the rules, and so forth. And with that as a lead-in, Cassandra, I'm going to ask you, what is your definition of social justice, and do you agree or disagree that it should exist?
My definition of social justice entails just the fair treatment of all persons. I believe that unless we can sit and acknowledge that things are not always fair and find a way to level the playing field, then we're not really moving towards social justice. In order to have social justice at its best, there needs to be adequate distribution of resources. And if there aren't any resources available, then as I stated earlier, in leveling the playing field, we need to find out by acknowledging that there is an issue, take ownership of what things contributed to the issue, and then make provisions to deal with the issues. So, you know, I don't believe we can really say that there's justice socially unless we've looked at it from, through those lens.
Well, I know we're not the first one to even talk about that, but Ernest Hemingway, I think in his book, Have and Have Nots, and now a very popular television program by Tyler Perry, shows the have and the have nots. And the tenet of the United States American Constitution saying that you can pursue happiness by capitalistic means, by its very nature, suggests there will be those who have and those who will have not. So in the face of a system designed for money being a driving point, that avaricianness is not bad, that if I can earn the money and I can build a big house and I can lord that over you, is that wrong?
No, I don't believe that it's wrong, but once, you know, as I earlier stated, it's about leveling the playing field and acknowledgement and ownership. You know, if you have the big house, if you've learned how to live well in America, I feel like there's a responsibility that you have to educate those less fortunate. Or if you are in a position of power, I feel that there's a responsibility to utilize that power to be as fair as you possibly can be over the folks that you have that delegated authority in fair pay, in diligent decisions. So all of that leads into what you stated earlier about personal responsibility. I think one should enjoy the fruits of their labor. You know, I'm completely for that. But I believe also in that we have a community responsibility to help those who are less fortunate.
So if I hire somebody as my maid and somebody else is my chauffeur and someone else is my lawn care person, am I not then sharing my wealth and therefore leveling the playing field?
Yes, you're sharing your wealth. And to be a little bit more specific, there's an individual that I know who has a child who is doing extremely well. And this individual is over a group of people who are of a lower socioeconomic status. And it always bewilders me that this individual who knew how to get their daughter out through grants, through scholarships, won't bring that information back to this group of people so they can find resources for their children. We have children who were A students who could have went to college, but they didn't know anything about how to get grants and scholarships. That's what I mean when I say we have a responsibility to at least educate and inform. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with having a nanny. There's nothing wrong with having someone cut your grass. There's nothing wrong with having someone clean your house or be your chauffeur. Yet, if you know that person has a goal or has a child or has a relative who really has the potential to exceed that, and you, for lack of a better word, hide the ball, I think that you're not promoting equality. I think you do have a personal responsibility to share not just the wealth of your money but the wealth of your knowledge.
Well, I guess you can tell I'm playing the devil's advocate, and it just popped in my mind. In the movie Help, it showed people who had means, but yet the persons who they shared their home through a manual task level could not see them as people. They saw them as less than themselves. And I think the big pivot in that movie was the whole concept that someone could clean their toilet, but that same someone couldn't use their toilet. So I guess that raises the issue of, and I can't get away from it, I guess in the United States they'd love it if we would get away from it, but in the movie Help, it showed the aristocratic belief that if my skin is white, then I am better than, I am more than, I am entitled to the better things of life. And the way in which I show someone who does not have white skin a kindness is by giving them a job. But at no time do I think they should commingle with me. In other words, don't be at my parties. And in some extreme cases, it was shown in the movie, they didn't even think you should commingle your fecal material with their own by putting a ban on the use of the toilet, but giving you full authority to clean the toilet. I guess when we look at those kinds of extreme thinking, I think it gives the paradigm or it actually in my mind shows up how difficult it is to share. You gave the example of when you know of opportunity, you should avail that opportunity to others. Well, if in my heart I believe you are incapable of receiving what I have, and in my heart I don't want to waste my time sharing to someone who can't receive, how do we get through that dilemma? Because I can tell you, if you just listen to Donald Trump, there are very wealthy people who are clinging to the concept that there are those who they would call beneath them, there are those who have an inability to utilize whatever tools they might offer in assistance to allow them to climb up the ladder, so to speak. So what would be your voice to that kind of person?
My voice would be to challenge belief systems One of the things that I enjoy doing in counseling is working with people on a genogram. And as you're well aware, that's just where you trace their family of origin and look for similar patterns in their family of origin to help them gain some insight as to patterns that they're following, things that they're doing. So I think in challenging belief systems, you know, I do that in my own professional and personal life. I'll say, Cassandra, what's up with that? When did you start thinking that way? What happened in your life that made you start doing things this way? And it requires meditation. It requires reflection. And so when you have people who have lived well and have forgotten how they made it, the people that helped them along the way, the acts of kindness that they received, or just kind of inheriting that. Even going back, it began with a story, and every beautiful story has a struggle in it. Even though people of wealth may not remember the struggle, one exists. And so that's why I say challenging faulty thinking and belief patterns, in my opinion, is the first way to begin the process of acquiring the knowledge necessary to challenge all of these faulty thinkings about who's better than someone else based on race, based on skin color.
Now, you really opened the can of worms for me. I'm smiling as you're talking. The very declaration of faulty thinking requires someone from the outside to impose some kind of a expectation. I mean, if I have all my life lived only with one color of people and my experiences are extremely limited with anybody else except my close friends and family and circle, and all of the literature information I get, whether it's on television or newspapers or if I read a book or if my family's talking at the country club, that I'm being told that the group that is not within my own is inferior. In fact, there's all kinds of things. They lie, they steal, they will rob you. If you happen to be blonde, blue-eyed, and light-skinned, you may even get raped because they want to ravage you. How can, in that situation, how can you help a person to know that their thinking is faulty if it's the only exposure and thinking they've ever had? By whose standard is it faulty?
Well, there has to be something inside of you that looks and say, why is everyone else doing something different? You know, there has to be enough wisdom inside the individual to say, let me challenge myself. What is this talk about Black Lives Matter? It never mattered to me, but why are people saying this? Why are people who look like me saying this? The first indication that there's a problem is that someone is alerting you. There's a light flashing that, you know what, slow down, warning, something's approaching, something's going on. You know, the person has to first be able to acknowledge and recognize that there is something that exists outside of themselves. We can't be so narcissistic that we believe that everything that exists is for us.
Well, that's interesting because there was a study. I think I was looking at LPB, the Louisiana Public Broadcast Channel, and someone had a group of college students, I think sophomore and junior. They didn't go for freshmen because they wanted to have had a group of young people who had had a chance perhaps to expand their mind being in a second or third year college environment. And the question was asked to a young white female, what did race mean to her? And her remark was, race does not apply to me because I'm white. That was her response. And I was listening, and I thought, wow, it never occurred to me that some young people can feel outside of the struggle, can feel beyond the problem. So if we have educated minds, and this person obviously had achieved some modicum of education, to feel the very concept of race and racial bias or racial improprieties didn't even concern her. And the reason was, in my mind, a very racist reason. She felt being white took her out of harm's way. And in a way, in the United States, she's not wrong, because if you are white and you're in a neighborhood that is predominantly white, you don't have anything to worry about. You'll get protected and you'll get all kind of support. Now, I don't know if she'd feel the same way if she had to walk through Harlem or some other predominantly black environment at a time when it was not a lot of white people on the street. But her feeling was race had no meaning to her because she was white. So how would you respond to that kind of thing?
Well, if she was living in a exclusive white society, I guess she would not have any problems. But even as simple as interfacing with folks at the grocery store, at the restaurant, you know, at all times we have to understand cultural diversity. We're living in a time where you interface with multiple races of individuals. Down in Shelby, North Carolina, where I live, it is not uncommon to just, when you go to the hospital, you know, there are medical doctors from India, Africa. I mean, you just never know of Asian descent. You never know who you're going to have to interface with. So that young lady is a person who has a serious problem, not just internally, but externally. And so my heart goes, you know, my heart goes out to her because
I'm laughing because if you and she were to be in the same room, I know she would not give you the same compassion because in her mind, you have the problem. She doesn't have a problem. She's a white American. She doesn't have a problem. Race doesn't affect her. But anyway, I thought that was interesting because the interviewer didn't know how to respond, essentially. I was watching this on a televised station.
I would want to know where she lived.
I don't know where her,
Because, you know, I don't care what color the person is. I'm always nice to whoever's serving my food.
<You know. laughs> And we wonder why. But no, I'm saying I don't know where she originated from, but she was going to school in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I can tell you where she was going to school, but I don't know what her background. Now, I'm going to share a little bit, and this is a little anecdotal, and I do introduce my personal experiences when I'm talking, and if any of my listeners want to call in and give their 2 cents worth, as it says, please feel free, dial 347-945-6594, and if time allowed, I'd certainly like to hear from you. But I was in Salt Lake City, Utah. At the time, I was working for Westinghouse, and my task was to train sailors. They call them ELTs. They were laboratory technician. I guess E is like E1, E3, or E5. I don't know what their position was, but it was referred to as ELTs. And there's any naval persons out there, they'll know what I'm talking about. And while I was in Salt Lake City, I went very naive. I thought, okay, I'm living in the United States. I'd been out of the country before. I'd been to Africa. I'd been to Mexico. Didn't even think about the extremities that we have in pockets of the United States. Why am I telling you this? While in Utah, I went to a grocery store, since you mentioned it, and I created such a problem by my very presence. It seemed there was no black females, I don't know if any black men, in that entire area where I was living. And when I went to the grocery store, it was a total disruption of a normal situation. I had persons in that store following me. And at first I thought, do they think I'm going to steal something or what? Now, I'm dressed in a business outfit. I'm not in, you know, fatigues or anything. I really look like a business person. And as I walked down one aisle and came up another, there's more and more people who would leave what they were doing. I mean, abandon their baskets and literally follow me. And when, by the time I got up to checkout, there was a bold little girl who was seated in the little cart ahead of me, and she reaches out and she starts rubbing my arm as if she was trying to rub off my brown skin. I don't know her intent, but she was a child, so I tolerated it. And she kept looking at my face and back at my arm, and she's rubbing vigorously. Mother never told her to stop. And when I turned to look, there had to be 20, maybe 25 people just following me. Now, I don't know if they thought I was going to go down on all fours or if my tail was going to pop out or something. I don't know their motivation, but that was the reaction. The young lady doing checkout was blushing so heavily. She was almost purple by the time I was setting my products out. I don't even know if she looked down long enough to know what she was registering or if she even picked up everything that I was registering. But her reaction was so extreme, as was everybody in the store. Now, I can't explain it, but I don't feel that my presence educated them in the least. I felt as if I were a zoo animal. You know how you go to the zoo and you see a panther or a tiger or some ferocious animal caged in this little box? You'll never get the full extent of the power of that animal because it's confined and it's caged. Well, I kind of feel that way when I go into an environment where the people's minds are so closed that my presence is not even offering them an education. They're rather trying to test their theory. Did I stink? Would my color rub off? Did I have a tail? Would I walk on all fours? I didn't get any sense that anyone there was challenging their own thinking, but rather trying to verify if the folklore about me was true. So I guess the concept of exposure being enough, when you're saying you go to a hospital and you see international persons, or if you go to a grocery store, if the mind is not open to change, I don't think exposure will hurl in a non-narcissistic thought. So as when you were saying that, I smiled because I'm wondering, you have this very generous idea of if the person is exposed to diversity, they will embrace diversity. Did I misinterpret what you were saying?
I wouldn't say exposure leads to immediate embracing, but it leads to acknowledgement. I may not fully embrace or accept all that I'm exposed to, but now I'm aware of it. Becoming aware of something begins to minimize my thoughts and opinions about what I used to believe. As I interface and talk to you about race relationships and these kinds of issues, I'm laughing, not because it's funny, but I'm aware of my own ignorance to some things because of the age difference. I've had similar experiences, but not as profound in some areas. And so with exposure comes this little beam of light that something outside of what you've witnessed may be out there. Now, whether or not the person who's embraced that, that's up to the individual, but they can no longer say, I never was exposed to it. I never knew about it. I didn't know these things exist. I didn't know this type of people exist. So I believe that exposure is good. It doesn't lead to automatic embracing, but it is.
Well, I think you have a very generous opinion of people who want to hate, and that's how I put it, want to hate. Why do I phrase it that way? Again, I'm going to go off into my crypt and introduce something else that happened to me. I was at a very vulnerable age, between 14 and 15. I graduated school early, so it was my summer after my junior year. And I had an opportunity. One of the persons who worked at a library found out that I could type. Now, at that time, those of you who have never heard of it, we had to use a typewriter, and we had stencils. We didn't have Microsoft Word. We could not just backspace and correct a word or get spell check to fix it for us. We literally had to commit. And when you type something on a stencil, you were doubly committed because we didn't even have a way to erase very well off of a stencil. And if you did not know how to erase on a stencil, you got a real black smudge. So the person who was a stenographer or typist had to have a certain level of skill. Well, just because we were always looking for ways to earn money, my family were very aggressive that way, I learned how to type. I took typing in high school, then later perfected it on some old typewriter. And this particular person found out I could type, and she hired me. And I would literally walk from my house to Cleveland College at the time. That shows you how far my walk was, Cassandra, because you know the distance from my parents' house to that location. And I would type. Well, they had five or six other people there, four of which were mature white females. Now, I was not yet 16, but there were some in there, I'm sure, were nearly 40. And they had been typing most of their life, and we also had to do some shorthand. And my challenge was to see how much faster I could get and how much cleaner could I do my stencils. And so when I took on this challenge, I excelled. And one of the persons, we were typing a textbook for somebody, someone was trying to publish, came out, and she was very congratulatory of my skills, and, oh, my goodness, the stencils are clean, and the words are spelled correctly, and da-dee-da-da. And then she went back to her big office. So we're back in the secretarial pool, and I'm starting to work again. And one of the ladies who were typing turned and started talking to the other. And here's what she said. She says, and I won't use the N-word because people find that offensive, but she did use the N-word. And in North Carolina, they pronounce it in such a way, they try to make it sound like they're saying neighbor, not neighbor, they're saying. And she was saying, most neighbors will steal and lie and cheat, and I hate to be around them. And she's saying this, and suddenly I'm hearing her, and I'm starting to feel uncomfortable, and she turns and she looks at me, and she says, no, 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 not you. You are okay. You can type. I'm not talking about you. And at that very tender age, I realized that even when you are among some people, and you are performing the task they are performing, and you're excelling at a task that they aren't doing as well, you will be okay for that task. But when the language turned to represent the group that I represent, they never said, gee whiz, look what I learned. This young lady who's not yet 16 is performing at a high level, following directions, and doing a good job. That's not what they saw. That's not what was the conversation. It allowed them to feel more comfortable to have their conversations in front of me, but my presence did not alter their thinking. And that really blew me away. I said, okay.
I guess, Dr. Bowles, the reason why I'm hopeful is during my 4 years as chaplain, I had an opportunity to walk with Caucasians at the brink of death. Death. And I don't know symbolically what I represented, but it was never uncommon for a 70 plus, 80 plus person, you know, on their way to another life, I'll say.
I thought you were going to say. Oh, okay, not on the way to heaven. Go ahead.
Another life. I can't, that's not within my power to say. But
I'm messing. Go ahead.
Hold my hand. Kiss my hand, say I love you, and have even went as far as to ask for forgiveness. So when I say I'm always hopeful, it is a shame if that was the only time that flashing light that I referenced earlier resonated that maybe it's time to reconcile some things. I would hate that any of us wait to that time of life to deal with things that we should have dealt with earlier. And so when I say I'm always hopeful, I want to say that I am aware and sensitive to all of the hurt that exists. I've been a direct recipient of it, but it's been those chaplaincy experiences that have shaped my thinking that at some point in life we are faced with whatever decisions we made, good, bad, or indifferent, and have an opportunity, should we choose to take it, to rethink some things. Does it minimize or change the hurt of the people that we hurt? No. Because they don't know they're in that moment. I'm saying I've seen those moments exist. And so it's not that I minimize anybody's hurt or struggle, because I tell you, it takes effort for me to enter into relationships with Caucasians in my area where I live because of the things that have taken place. There's always this reserve. There's always this place of distrust. And I have to fight against that to not treat that person as they are representative of the people who impacted my life. And that requires work. It requires hard work. So by no means am I fluffing it or attempting to. I'm just acknowledging and sharing that the reason why I am hopeful is that I've been afforded the opportunity to walk with people late in life in transition who asked me to atone for something that I didn't directly experience with them.
Well, you've just opened the door to our next conversation, because I did want to talk about the difference between personal realization and legislatured realization. When we say social justice in the United States, it is implied in that title that we're talking about a larger body than just an individual. And you guess what, Cassandra, we have run out of time. So, listeners, I hope you will stay tuned for our next episode, where we will talk about the government, United States, and legislatured social justice. And with that, I thank you so much for listening. And until next time, take care.